Good evening, and before we start the show tonight, I just wanted to tell you that during the recording of this episode, we experienced a number of technical difficulties. In fact, no fewer than 8 times did we lose communication between point A and point B. And so, about 13 minutes into the podcast, you will hear where we had to switch from using Skype to using a telephone. And it does make a significant difference to the audio quality, but I think it's acceptable enough. We hope you enjoy the episode, and we apologize about the quality of the audio. And now on with the show.
Listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene, and tonight Ben couldn't join us, so we have Simon with us. Hello, Simon. How you doing?
Hello. Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Merry Christmas to you. And it is indeed Christmas that we're talking about, because it is the special Doctor Who Christmas special, A Christmas Carol by Stephen Moffat, which has aired round the world by now, which is unusual for a Doctor Who Christmas special. And we can talk about that a little bit later. But let's just get right into it. Simon, any initial thoughts on this episode?
I have to say, I mean, the obviously this episode was, there was a clue in the title, a Christmas Carol, and it's
does sound familiar,
quite heavily from another popular tale of the same name. Actually, the thing that struck me about this episode, and the thing that I've remembered 24 hours after having watched it and thinking about it, is just how the design and photography of this is so... I thought it was really beautifully done, this episode. The visuals of it, the colour palette is very... There's sort of blues and golds, and there's snow and there's mist. And there are these fish that are swimming around in the air, and it's wonderful and incredibly imaginative. And we were promised when Stephen Moffat took up the reins that we were going to get a fairy tale version of Doctor Who. And to some extent, I think that's been the direction that the last season has gone. But this has been very... There's definitely been a very strong fantasy element to this story, which I'd be interested to get your take on. But I have to say, I'm quite taken by, and also a lot of illusions in the imagery and the photography of it, the Rat Pack element, the sort of it nods to It's a Wonderful Life and the 1940s movies. I mean, it may be the several helpings of Christmas pudding and the brandy and the port and Stilton that I consumed before watching it, but I enjoyed this one a lot. I thought it was very good.
I did enjoy it. I watched with my family, and I'm not sure that was entirely the universal decision. In fact, my dad, who watches them, was completely disliked it, which I thought was odd. But then I don't think he likes A Christmas Carol, and has ever liked that story. So, and I don't know if they do this in British television or not. I can't recall it from any of the shows I've seen imported over here, but it is almost a joke that, in particular in the 70s and the 80s, that virtually every TV show would put out a Christmas episode and they would rip off A Christmas Carol wholeheartedly. From the episode where the $6 million man had to go against a defense contractor who was being a Scrooge, literally, and putting in substandard parts because the contract said he could, so he used his bionic powers to fake his past, present, and future to make him turn. I mean, it's such a tired cliche that, frankly, when I heard this episode was going to be a Christmas Carol, I kind of slapped my head and go, oh, please, not again. I am so tired of that.
I'm not aware of it occurring a lot in British television. I mean, there's one standout example. I don't know if you're a Blackadder fan, but there's the...
Oh, yes.
The wonderful Blackadder's Christmas Carol.
That one was different, yes, because it was a comedy and it was...
Well, it probably sends up exactly the kind of thing you're talking about. I won't give it all away, but suffice it to say that this story starts with the wonderful, generous-hearted, warm and giving Edmund Blackadder, or Ebenezer Blackadder, I think it may be in that case, who is visited by accident by the ghost of Christmas past, present, and future. But I think that's probably sending up the thing you're talking about, which is drawing in a very cliched and unoriginal way on Dickens' story. So I'm curious to know how you thought Stephen Moffat's take on that old tale went then.
I was very pleasantly surprised, because despite the fact that it's been advertised as being a Doctor Who version of A Christmas Carol, and the fact that it's called A Christmas Carol, and all expectations from the pictures are that it's, you know, there's a guy who's Scrooge and the Doctor traveling through time and all that stuff, but it really wasn't. I mean, it was not the same story as A Christmas Carol at all, which was a story of a man being forced to reflect upon his life as opposed to what the Doctor did to him, which is a very different thing. So in that case, I thought Mr. Moffat was being terribly clever. And in keeping with what you said earlier, I thought that they went out of their way to make this episode magical. Not magical in the terms of it's just like the greatest story ever, but in terms of the look, the feel, what he was doing, all of that stuff was really meant to be sort of a young at heart and having fun, interlaced with a certain amount of drama, but it was meant to be a magical special. I think that was the right word for it. I thought the grading of the blue color was a little too much in a lot of the places, but it did create that very sort of Victorian empty house feel that Scrooge used to that lived in, and in this case Sardik lived in. But that was something Ben and I have discussed before. I think color grading's been overused lately, but it worked. You know, I'm kind of a little painfully aware of it at this point, but so it was very heavy on the blue in times. But apart from that, I thought they did a very nice job. I thought it was a good Christmas special compared to some of the others in the past, which I'm not as crazy about.
Well, I would agree with that. I mean, I think I've enjoyed some of the Christmas specials, and the revival of the Doctor Who Christmas special. Certainly from Twitter, I'm getting the impression now that people are remembering that the true meaning of Christmas is about a man who saves other people. And so Christmas is all about Doctor Who Day.
Yes.
And that tradition is something that it's felt like there's been a need to live up to. That. That hasn't always quite worked, but this felt like a really satisfying way to round off Christmas Day.
This was different. I thought this was very different from the previous Christmas specials. I think that the switch from Davies to Moffat, I think Moffat has taken this a different direction. And I'll tell you, when I was a kid, and partially because we always got these Christmas Carol remakes, and I dreaded Christmas time on television, because all of the shows that you watched, all of the things that you enjoyed, and typically in the United States, particularly back when I was younger, they started the new TV series about September, and all shows ran about 22 to 30 weeks, which would cover Thanksgiving and Christmas. And when they got to Thanksgiving, when they got to Christmas, basically the shows would just step out, do a lighthearted kind of Christmassy themed episode. And I never liked that. And I know that's very different from the way that they do Christmas in Britain, because, you know, we're beginning to see that now, that you have like a big day of Christmas programming and a couple days on either side where they do that. And I like this one, and I normally don't. Not just because of the way I am about Christmas, which is not totally... I'm not totally on board with it, but I enjoy the Christmas holiday. Exactly.
But I think that's true, but it's partly a function of the way that British television works, in the sense that we have much shorter series.
Right.
And then having a Christmas special is a way of getting an extra episode, and we're aware of it because when we get the American series imports, we do get that mid-season Christmas special episode.
Probably usually, in July.
However, yeah, it's July, and it's blazing sunshine outside, and Christmas, it's a good month. If we're talking about July, it's a good month before Santa turns up at the shopping mall. So, you know.
Yes, we also get those when all these shows go into reruns, which is, of course, our plague, far worse than it is yours. So they come any time of the year. Weird coincidence. I've been watching through Gilligan's Island, which I guess they never showed in Britain, which you're probably lucky for, but I'm introducing my kids to that culturally. And coincidentally, I pulled out an episode that's the next that we've been watching on the DVD and put it in for the kids yesterday, and it was the Christmas episode of Gilligan's Island, which I've never seen on Christmas before, or even anywhere close to Christmas. And it was complete coincidence, but it was almost a pleasant surprise for a change. See that. Anyway, I'd like to talk just a little bit about the older Doctor Who Christmas shows. I mean, we've had the Christmas Invasion, which I know you were liked very much, and I'm fond of in certain reasons very well. The Runaway Bride, The Voyage of the Damned, The Next Doctor, and do we really count The End of Time as a Christmassy story?
Definitely not.
Yeah. I thought all of those previous ones were obviously all set at Christmas time, and yes, they had spinning, whirling Christmas trees and Santas that were robots that attacked, but Christmas was not really integral to any of those stories. And what I mean by that is that they had the trappings of Christmas, they had the occasional Christmassy thing in them, decorations, talking about Christmas, perhaps always a snow. Always a Christmas snow, I think, at the end of every one. But they just weren't about Christmas. And this one was. And I think that was really... I can't think of any of the others being anything other than coincidentally set at Christmas time. Can you?
No, I think that's absolutely true. And the fact that this one was set at Christmas and it had all of these... I suppose the time travel thing is I want to touch on that. That's kind of incidental to this point, which is that you had all of these Christmas Eves, and it was Christmas specifically that was the running theme through all of
Halfway all Out of the Dark.
Yes, I agree. And that Halfway Out of the Dark theme was a lovely way of bookending both the beginning and the end of the episode, and bringing in this Christmas winter solstice theme that layered in this adventure that the Doctor went on, reliving all of these various Christmas Eve stories and adventures through it all, that managed to build up this sense of having been through this long, this life, really, of the Scrooge character. I agree. This was a genuine Christmas episode. This was about something that you couldn't have told at another time of year.
Yes. Stephen Moffat, better Christmas stories.
Yes, indeed. And the other thing that interests me about this was, I mean, you mentioned that there were others watching with you, the not we's, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason, let's be honest, largely because there was an extensive combing of the Christmas schedule and nothing else was on that interested my sister and her boyfriend. And so they decided that, well, they might as well watch Doctor Who with me in that case. And at the start of the episode, when you've got that scene with the ship crashing through the clouds,
mm-hmm.
and it does look somewhat reminiscent of the Bridge of the Enterprise.
It's a galaxy-class ship, too, which is what the Star Trek Next Generation Enterprise is. I noticed that.
I thought you might be able to pin it down even more specifically than I might. But my sister looked at that and that she almost walked out at that point, I think. Oh, there was a groan and, oh, God, sci-fi. And by the end of the episode, when my dad came in and said, oh, and my dad had seen some of these previous episodes we talked about. He'd seen, although he has no recollection of it, he'd seen The Runaway Bride, and he'd seen the one with Kylie Minogue, mm-hmm. which he hadn't thought too much of. When he came in and said, well, what do you think of it? The verdict was actually, oh, that was quite good.
I mean, my kids seemed to enjoy it. So, I mean, that was the you know, flying with a shark and all the fun stuff like that. So, I mean, there was a lot to entertain with the kids. But, like I say, my dad put it as the worst episode of Doctor Who he's ever seen. Literally, that was his verdict on it. And
so how many episodes has he seen?
All of them.
Is he a hardcore fan?
All of them. He's seen them all, I think.
That's fairly hardcore, yeah.
I mean, you know, that's I have them, and my dad likes science fiction to some degree. He's not a hard science fiction fan, but I mean, and he has watched them over the years. And, you know, he's not what you'd call a tried and true. I mean, for example, he cannot stand Patrick Troughton as the Doctor. He won't watch them. He's seen them and he won't watch them again. And Sylvester McCoy, he detests even more. But John Pertwee, Tom Baker, you know, he considers those good. He liked David Tennant. He even likes Matt Smith as the Doctor, but he just did not like this episode at all. And I don't know, my wife was kind of, eh. You know, she didn't think it was as good as the rest of the season, the prior season. I thought it was different. I mean, I felt that it filled a different role, that it felt like it was meant to be a Christmas special, and you really just kind of had to divorce it from the rest of the series and not say it's not part of the Doctor Who. It's part of the Doctor Who mythos, but it's just kind of meant to be pitched and themed differently than the rest of the series.
Because there's a little bit of my brain, that sort of the hardcore nerd that's already actually composing that post for putting up on Outpost Gallifrey, that's thinking when, and I saw you posting on Twitter about this as well, that there was a whole time travel thing, and then it culminated in the elder and the younger of the Scrooge characters touching, and you were thinking, what about the Blinovich limitation effect?
There should have been a huge release of temporal energy right there.
Exactly, and even in more recent episodes, when Rose picked herself up in Father's Day, this almost caused the Earth to be wiped out from history,
mm-hmm.
and yet. You have that, and obviously you have the whole question of temporal interference in Doctor Who, and again, even recently in Stephen Moffat penned episodes and The Girl in the Fireplace, you had the explanation from the Doctor that he was unable to use the TARDIS to change things because he couldn't interfere in his own timeline. And in this episode, obviously, what he does is interfere in his own timeline.
Right, and he has an excuse for not using the TARDIS in this one, but I couldn't hear what it was. So, and he does, but he does use the TARDIS, but he can't use it to rescue the people on the ship. So I don't quite know. Let's I guess, you know, since this episode has shown worldwide, which is a first, I guess we can kind of assume that most people who want to see it have seen it by the time they're listening to this. What did you think about the idea of the Doctor going back to his earlier life, not the Doctor's, but Sardix, and changing his memories? And as he changed his memories, the guy in the future was remembering what memories had been changed. And I noticed that there was, in most instances, it seemed as if he was reliving it, kind of in his mind, as the memories changed. In one instance, particularly where he was telling the Doctor not to go out the door, I almost felt like he was remembering what hadn't yet happened to the Doctor, that there was a shark outside. And I thought that was just, obviously we can write it off as timey-wimey, but it was kind of, you know, I confused, almost like we weren't really sure what was happening with his rewriting. And for example, they also, the picture of his father changed into the picture of Abigail for a while, and then it changed back to the picture of his father. If the Doctor had stopped interfering or stopped going one Christmas Eve earlier, would the picture have stayed Abigail?
Well, I think we have a bit of a problem as Doctor Who fans here, because there are just so many accounts of time travel, the effects of time travel, and whether or not you can interfere with it, that are contradictory, and that we've almost got to pick and choose. And certainly in the recent Moffat episodes, the idea that time is in flux, that time can be changed, has been pushed quite heavily. That's something that has been contradicted in the past. I mean, I guess if you care about it, you can write it off on the basis that time is actually phenomenally complicated and you can't have one simple rule that works all of the time or something like this. But in terms of drama, you can also say, if it's effective, then it works. And for me, there was something very powerful about that whole setup where Sardik was actually being influenced by the changing of the timeline. So somehow he remembered his past and his new past simultaneously. And the way it had been visually represented, and the way it was layered with the black and white projections from his unreal past being projected over the surroundings, the trappings of his present, the room he was in, and the fact that you could see them both at once, I thought that was a very clever sort of visual metaphor for what was going on there with the simultaneous old and new pasts.
Right.
And present, as it were. I'm getting confused myself now, but that may be the number of pickled partridges I've drunk.
Which, for our American listeners, is a form of, is that a lager? A beer?
It's an alcoholic beverage formed by the fermentation of barley. It's not
the fermentation of partridges, though.
No. Well, no, as far as I'm aware, and just in case there are any animal rights activists listening, no partridges were harmed in the making of any drinks. Fish, possibly, but not the flying fish type that we saw in the episode.
I thought the flying fish was kind of, again, it was sort of the magical sort of flying fish. It was a neat idea. I think I probably would have liked them a little bit better if they hadn't obviously been earth fish, like the shark.
I mean, there was, in terms of fantasy elements, there's just something incredibly imaginative and wonderful about having these shoals of fish swimming around and having the doctor just reach out his hand and these fish come up and investigate it. And then this enormous and incredibly scary shark coming and biting his sonic screwdriver in half. I loved all that, actually.
I loved the line. There were many, many funny lines in this. I mean, I think when Stephen Moffat was writing this, he was tweeting that I was laughing when I was writing this. And there were a lot of this show was about the doctor saying funny things. And I must admit, I laughed out loud when he was talking about retrieving the sonic screwdriver from inside the shark because he thought the shark's mouth was probably wedged open. And he said something, they said, well, where is the screwdriver? And he said, well, the good news is it's in reach. The bad news is I only have two goes, and then it's your turn. And the kid's like, what? And he says, only two arms. And so it was, there was a lot of just little clever, quippy comments. But I did think Matt Smith's doctor was just a little different than in the previous episodes. Again, he was lighter. He was being a little more scattered mentally. I don't know if that's the direction or that was the fit with the Christmas story, but he felt a little different. It wasn't just his jacket being sullied.
I was impressed by I've mentioned before that I think Matt Smith is rather good in the role, but I was particularly impressed. I think this is the point where I'm kind of starting to think that Tennant was good and he was different, but there was something about Matt Smith in this that took it up a notch. And we've seen him do the kind of rubber-faced, rubber-legged clown, you know, rolling out of the fireplace and jesting with the young child, you know, stay off the naughtiness and all of that. But actually, also, he's doing more and more with less and less. That scene where they had their backs against the door and he had his sonic screwdriver suspended on that piece of rope, and he was chatting to the young Sardaukar, saying, "Why are you interested in these fish?" And Sardaukar was saying, "Well, because they scare me." And he's saying, "Interesting answer." And he just had such a lot packed in to his delivery of some of those lines. I'm more and more taken with his performance.
He's doing a great job. I really like him, and I you know, David Tennant sealed the role for me in Christmas Invasion, in his first story, when he gets out there and with the sword and I don't know. I mean, he had it. That was it. He was the doctor. I shouted. If you look at classic Doctor Who and you see the transition from Hartnell to Troughton as being a sort of, from a straight man to sort of a funny man. And, you know, maybe he went back a little bit to a straight man with Pertwee, and then he went to a funny man again with Baker. And then, of course, as it went beyond Davison, it just kind of progressed out of control. But I kind of see a parallel here in that Eccleston was about as, I don't want to say dull, but he's about as a straight man as Hartnell was. Except he didn't even have the benefit of being an irascible old man. And Tennant, I like Tennant better because he is a little bit weirder.
He's got incredibly good comic timing, and that for me the weakness of Eccleston was that he was being written jokes, but he didn't deliver them with the kind of understanding that Tennant gave.
And then Matt Smith's Doctor is probably even weirder still than
Yeah, he's got. I mean, his timing's very offbeat. It's almost like it throws you. It's unexpected, but he's very funny.
Yeah.
And you know, some of the gags in this, and also some of the. I mean, there's another. While we're talking about the comparison between the Russell T. Davies Doctors and the new Stephen Moffat and Matt Smith era, the one of the things that I thought was possibly a bit of a weakness in this episode that did seem to hark back to some of the previous Christmas specials was the very, very broad way in which the Sardic character was sketched out in the early scenes. So you had to have him on the phone slapping down the president, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's a broad brush way of sort of explaining to the young audience, you know, this is a powerful and mean man, but it's maybe a little bit too broad, perhaps.
I thought that was I thought that was one of the clever bits, because you are, we've been told this is a Christmas carol. I mean, right up at front, it's a Christmas carol. You know this guy is going to be Scrooge, and he starts off doing the Scrooge, I mean, the classic Scrooge stuff. Just, it's right into your brain. You know who he is. You know everything about him. You know Scrooge. And then he doesn't hit the boy. And the doctor sees it.
And this
is not Scrooge after all. So we are given the stereotype, and then they deconstruct it. I mean, first the doctor deconstructs, and then he rebuilds him. But I think Moffat was playing with us by starting the guy off with those broad strokes and wide characterization.
And I understand why the wide characterization is drawn. You know, you have only limited time to draw people in. But I also thought that later on in the episode, there were some very, very economical scenes where you told a great deal of story in a very, very small amount of space that hugely impressed me. I mean, the Rat Pack illusions, Matt Smith's change of costume into his white jacket when he was supposed to be at Frank Sinatra's estate,
mm-hmm.
with Marilyn Monroe pursuing him, and Sardik and the Catherine Jenkins character by a swimming pool. I mean, that was all of 2 minutes or something, but it was so, it just built it all so cleverly. In fact, that whole scene where the doctor crashes in on them and he's you know, circling them, aren't you ever going to come up for breath, poking them in the head or whatever. And it's the middle of this incredibly heartbreaking scene where she's just told him she's one day to live, and there are tears running down their faces, and they don't even notice the doctor.
Yeah.
There's such a lot in it. It's hugely impressive writing, I think.
They push the idea that the doctor has not the slightest clue what to do with women in this a lot. I thought that was driven home several times. Not the least of which was the line where he tells the boy to go back and, to go back and kiss her. And he said, "It's this or go to your room and design a new kind of screwdriver," which and another terribly funny line, which I've just stolen.
don't make the mistakes I made, he tells him.
It had a lot of interesting things going on in that. Now I have a question, just for the sake of argument. Not for the sake of argument, for the sake of my curiosity. Is it still correct? I'm pretty sure it used to be correct that in the UK you can only get married in a church?
Yeah, it's not correct anymore.
Not correct anymore, but it used to be.
A church or registry office, but that's no longer the case.
Okay. Because that has not been the case in the United States for quite a while. So is that line about the doctor at the end saying that that was never a real chapel when he was talking about his marriage to Marilyn Monroe? I thought that might be something for the audience there that, that would know that if you don't get married in a chapel, it's not legal. But, of course, little does he know, well, it was here. So he's obviously Marilyn Monroe's husband.
Well, yes, and it might have been there. I mean, briefly yesterday, I do hope this isn't apocryphal, but briefly yesterday I understand that the entry for Marilyn Monroe on Wikipedia was edited to include that in the 1950s, rumours circulated that Monroe had eloped with an unnamed stranger in a bow tie she met during a party at Frank Sinatra's Hollywood estate. The marriage was never confirmed, however, due in part to the fact it may not have taken place inside a real chapel.
Which just proves that Wikipedia can be a fun and exciting place to get your research material.
Oh, yes.
It's been fixed, I understand, as well. But you gotta come back a couple days later and make sure it's a couple things I just wanted to point out, that I little notes along the way I don't think we've covered. I noticed at the beginning the planet is right near the Horsehead Nebula, which I thought that was interesting. Interesting shot that they had something real astronomical in the back. Doesn't really mean anything, but it's unusual to see something that you would recognize in the stars.
So have you located the planet?
I haven't. I don't think I could do that. But the very opening shot, as they pan around, the Horsehead Nebula is very clear, just off the side of the planet. It's still quite a ways away, so.
The opening would have been a reference to, I guess, to those openings with the long shots and then the massive zooms into Earth.
Yeah, yeah.
For once, we don't have an Earth set Christmas special.
Oh yeah, I hadn't even thought about that. That's right. All the others have been set on Earth, haven't they?
Yeah, and at first, I did find it. We talked about the fact that, you know, it was a broad brush scene setting with what the scenario was on this planet, and the fact here you have a powerful businessman and he's got the president his beck and call. I found that a little difficult to, you know, you don't have a reference to grab onto in terms of Earth or the culture that you're supposed to be connecting with.
And yet all the scenes, as they, you know, wandered the streets while he was giving his little opening narration, you know, Christmas trees and what kind of looked sort of faux Victorian Edwardian clothing with some odd modifications.
It didn't take long to get into that, into the sort of steampunk kind of feel of that.
Yeah.
And there was plenty to pick up on, and yet you still had a sense that it was alien, and mm-hmm. it wasn't. So you didn't have to feel that it was in some way constrained by the realities of how it might have been an Earth set story.
Yeah.
Not least the wonderful thing of having the airfish.
Yeah, you really couldn't have the airfish on Earth, although maybe you could, and that would explain sharks, but anyway. I like the bit where the villain of the piece says that his wonderful device has isomorphic controls, and the doctor calls him a fibber and says that's not possible.
I thought that was another one that's going to set the forums alight.
Yeah, and of course, at one point, Tom Baker, and I cannot remember off the top of my head which episode it was, but he was telling somebody that they couldn't operate his TARDIS because the controls were isomorphic, and that never seemed to stop anyone else from ever flying the TARDIS, except in that one episode.
I seem to remember something in the Two Doctors about it. So whether it actually stopped anyone, I can't remember.
Yeah, so,
but I can equally remember other people flying it, so.
Yeah, so I think that safely put that to bed. The doctor was lying back then, and he knew he was lying, and that's why he thinks this guy's.
Or was he lying now?
Could be.
I think it safely made the whole thing as confusing as ever.
He did seem genuinely surprised.
Ambiguity.
Yeah. So is at one point the psychic paper fails to function when he tells a lie too big?
And he shorts it out.
He shorts it out. Does that mean it's gone forever? Have we seen the end of the psychic paper?
I doubt it. I don't think the shark biting the screwdriver in half has finished it off either.
Well, I think he'll get a new one. That way they can market a different type of sonic screwdriver for next year. I'll have to replace my son's sonic screwdriver with a new model. Well, we should talk a little bit about the guest stars and the acting in this. Of course, Rory and Amy are back, but not much in this episode. And Arthur Darvill, who plays Rory, got his name in the opening credits.
I noticed that. I noticed the fact that obviously the companion there, their role is changing slightly. They have played a minor role in this episode, so clearly they get most of the episode off, and that's nice for them. But also they have a much more equal relationship with the Doctor, I suppose, in the sense that there is a greater mutual trust now.
Yeah, and I think we did get to see some a little bit of how Rory and Amy are going to be as a couple, and particularly in the scene where the Doctor, Amy says, "Oh, something like it's going to be all right then," and the Doctor says, "Yeah, I've got a plan," and then she says, "Don't treat me like a fool or a child," I forget which it is, and the Doctor, "Okay, I don't really have a plan," and Rory turns around and says to Amy, because he's kind of overhearing the conversation, "Was he lying? Is he treating us like a fool?" And she says, "Oh, no, it's fine." So she just turns around and does it to him. So he's kind of, you know, one down the pole. She's Amy's companion, as it will. There was a flash of jealousy at the end, I think, where Rory was like, "Oh, so the Doctor gets all the credit." And if you think about it, rightly so. So, you know, he catches it very quickly that he's... you know, not to be jealous of it. It's simply the Doctor did, in fact, do all the work and save everyone and rightly deserves the credit for it. The guest stars in this, Michael Gambon, who probably is at least best known over here as Dumbledore in the later Harry Potter films, I thought did a particularly Scroogey job in the episode. As both himself and his father,
he was very good, all of the actors in the Sardis character were very good, and particularly the young boy, because child actors you can get. It was a story where you needed to have that child actor,
right?
And that can be a weak point, and it was an important segment of this story, and he was very, very good, I thought.
Yeah. It seemed very natural, so, I mean, that's probably the highest compliment I can think of, is that he didn't seem like he was acting or trying it. I thought Gambon was... He was playing an interesting part, because the older man was changing... Sort of. Through, I mean, how do you play somebody who has his memories and his entire life behind him, and he clearly still remembers it, and then at the same time has these new things being thrust upon him? That's an interesting... That would be an interesting job to get your head around if you were an actor, I would think. That... And I thought he did it well. When he was being nice, he really seemed nice. And when he was playing mean, he seemed mean, although I'd say overall he seemed a little more kindly than... I don't know how to describe... Do you remember when the master, Professor Yana... And I cannot think of that actor's name to save my life for a moment.
Derek Jacobi.
Yes. When he switched from kindly old man to evil master, that was...
Chilling.
And Gambon, even when he's being nasty, kind of seems like he's just mad. Not nasty, but mad. And maybe that was the way it was meant to be.
And angry, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, mad angry. Mad, like, kind of not mad, mad, mad insane, but yeah. So, and maybe that's the way he was supposed to be playing it. Maybe that's the whole point. His whole life, he's been angry. He's been, for whatever, for all the injustices done to him by his father, and not, so maybe, but it wasn't as clearly delineated as Jacoby's performance as the master. They had snow again in this episode, and it was brought on by Catherine Jenkins playing Abigail, who a lot of people thought was stunt casting, I think, in this, because she is a famous, not here, but she's a famous opera singer.
Yes, so I'm probably ought to be ashamed to admit it, being living in Wales and not being particularly aware of her. But having said that, I thought that we know this was her first acting role, and I didn't think it necessarily gave a great sense of the range she may be capable of, but the role was to look beautiful and sound beautiful, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought she did both of those.
She did both of those, yes.
The scenes in which she had to, particularly as I mentioned earlier, that scene by the swimming pool where she tells the truth to Sadiq, I think she did a very good job in the role.
Yes, I think she did a good job of the acting, and I say she does have a lovely voice. And the
music again. I mean, Marigold just seems to be surpassing herself with every new incarnation of the Doctor Who music, and this episode, I believe, is going to get a whole album of music released in its own right, and deservedly so, because, I'll be looking forward to that. I'll be getting that.
Yeah. Yeah. I in the past Christmas episodes, those have been the ones that have featured live singing.
Yes.
And I'm not crazy about any of the songs that they've had, except for the Dalek in Manhattan, where they also had the musical number. But for the most part, the singing has been contained to the Christmas episodes. And I guess I'm not too crazy. Those are the songs that are unchecked in my Doctor Who soundtracks in iTunes. But this one was integral to the plot, necessary. It wasn't just stuck on where we're at a party and they're going to sing a song kind of thing. And truly a lovely voice.
Singing into the sonic screwdriver. I mean,
that was
talking about the knotweeds, that even tickled my sister's sense of humor. So we enjoyed that.
Yeah. And so, yeah, all in all, I'd say this is the best Doctor Who Christmas episode ever. And I can't, like I say, I'm never looking forward to the Christmas episodes, except that you get an extra episode of Doctor Who during the long dark. And, you know, we're halfway there. We're halfway there to the next series of Doctor Who.
I hadn't even thought of that. And that's lovely, isn't it? It's in that whole theme. I mean, I've probably enjoyed the Christmas episodes a bit more, and perhaps because I like the Christmas Invasion, the sort of first of these revival Christmas episodes. But this did feel like it had taken it to a whole new level.
Well, I liked the Christmas Invasion once David Tennant woke up. But I have
that was probably only the last 5 minutes, so.
Maybe 10, 15, maybe. But the part earlier where they just were kind of Rose whining about how the Doctor could change on her and reflecting upon her life was a little bit slow. I know it gave them an opportunity, but you know, the Doctor had about as much part in that as Amy and Rory do in this one.
But this one, like you say, has Christmas plays a part in it as well. So it has a different feeling. I mean, it just, to me, there was a whole sense of both the imagery, which I thought was wonderful, but there were many, many allusions, and far more, I'm sure, than I've picked up on. But the sort of sense you got of Christmas Day in front of old black and white movies and James Stewart, and the fact that you actually had this projector and you had all of these illusions and the Rat Pack and all the rest of these things. It just had, as well as being about Christmas, it had an incredibly evocative sense of Christmas. It was as steeped in Christmas as a Christmas pudding is in brandy.
And I'm hoping that next year, on my Christmas tree, I have a flying shark ornament pulling a sleigh.
Oh, yes.
Because that would be just perfect, you know, for the sci-fi nerd kind of person. Not the Star Trek Enterprise or the shuttlecraft ornaments. I want a shark pulling a sleigh. So, anyone listening out there that does those things, shark pulling sleigh. Christmas. Get to it. You've got a year. Well, have you got anything else you want to mention on the episode?
No, I think that's it. I mean, all around, pretty much. Bravo, Mr. Moffat. Thank you.
Looking forward to the new series. We did get a little preview at the end.
Yes.
Any scenes in there in particular that... I did notice they had an awful lot of the colorful scenes from the Utah, Nevada deserts that they came over to the United States to shoot. And I wish I could say that Arizona's deserts were that pretty, but not quite. But then that's why you go there. Okay. Well, Simon, thank you very much for joining me for this episode, filling in for Ben.
Well, yes, it's been a pleasure. Only 364 more sleeps until the next Doctor Who Christmas special.
I think we'll have you back. We'll have you back long before then. So until next time, when Ben will be back and we'll be discussing the next episode of UFO, I believe. I'll say farewell to you, and thank you again, Simon.
Thank you, and it's been a pleasure. Merry Christmas again.
Merry Christmas, and Merry Christmas to all our listeners, even though it's going to be after Christmas before you get this, but it's the thought that counts. Better late than never. And hope you'll join us again next time on Fusion Patrol.
You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol podcast. We'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at feedback@fusionpatrol.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fusionpatrol, or look for us on Facebook. Fusion Patrol is a production of Lone Locust Productions. Our theme music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.